common denominator was the people that I kept, that I thought the most peace and joy from, were people who said they were working the steps. I said, that's what I got to do, right? You know? You could tell. There was a fucking difference. So, anyway, I finally finished this year. I did 12 steps, and I'm back on one now. And my life has totally changed, right? I mean, I live in a little, I call it little paradise. Wayne's my landlord. And I say, you guys live in a big paradise, and I live in a little paradise. Because they have a big place, and my place is tiny. But it's so, you know, it's so peaceful. It's all me. I got a little car. Well, it's not little. I always say little. It's just a regular car. But I paid for it, right? I got a little insurance bill. I got a little car. I got a little hat and a little neck and all that, you know. But it's all fucking little mine, you know. It's nobody else's. And it's the first time I've ever been all by myself. I don't have my parents. My parents enabled me. I mean, I had to say, look, it took me a long time to hit bottom because my mother was always, you know, oh, well, yeah, let her, you know, nah, you know, I would guilt trip her, you know, you want me to go out and do something? You know, I'd act like I was going to go prostitute or something, I'd be a good mother with that, right? I couldn't, and they were trying to train me how to prostitute, I sucked at that. I mean, I couldn't suck, so I wasn't good. These girls are like, so walk a little bit, and then they're like, yeah. And walk a little bit. Like when a car goes by, they're like that. And I'm like, I didn't get it, but I guess that means, you know. I'm like, it didn't work. And I had a boyfriend at the time, and he came and took me by the back, and he said, what are you doing with them pants? Like, the pants were so tight, I couldn't even breathe. The girls were like, put these on. And they're walking down the road. I was the worst prostitute for 2 minutes on earth. So, for guys would probably pay me to just shut the fuck up, will you? Be quiet, we'll give you a hint. So, anyway, I thought I was going to cry. I've been crying a lot this week. Like, my emotions, like, that's one of the gifts I have from this program and from being clean is that I can feel again. And I remember when I was getting high, and I thought, if my mom dies, I'm not going to be able to cry at the funeral. Because nothing affected me anymore, right? I was just like, all the time. And now, so you guys know I'm 4.5 years clean and like 2 years, I guess, out of transitional place, and I'm in real life. And like, I never thought I was gonna, maybe I would never love again, and maybe I would never have a broken heart again. And maybe, you know, what else? That was probably enough. But the pandemic helped me because, like, you can see, like, that I'm, like, a people kind of person. I'm not totally shy or anything. So, you know, if I had to sit, it's not in my nature to sit down and feel some shit, right? So the pandemic was really accelerated my recovery in that I had to sit and feel, what it felt like to not be with somebody that I really cared about, and how to acceptance, you know, I don't want to explain the whole thing, but okay, so acceptance is one of what, to me, everything comes down to in recovery that makes, or at least makes recovery simpler. If I accept where you are, right, and that we're different and we don't jive or whatever, I can go on, you know. If I accept that I don't drive a big fancy car, but I'm happy driving my little car that's paid for. Anyway, or I accept people for where they are. I lived in a place with 28 women, right? And we went from like 30 days clean to about 5 years clean. That's a lot. And we all came from different places. But the place was designed to take women from prison to transition back into the world and stuff. So I was in there with girls who did 20-year bits. These girls were like half my age, like murdered motherfuckers when they were 15. I'm not saying they did that shit on purpose, you know, but anyway. So I'm saying there were some hardcore women, they were loud, you know, whatever. You learn with 28 women. It's hard, like you want to be quiet so I can get some sleep, or you know, all this. But I have to like sit in my room sometimes and like, I accept, as soon as I could accept, she's just there, that's where she is, right? Like, I hope if you guys accept where I am right now, I don't know it. I don't know what you've taught me so far, right? And I'm eager to learn more. I'm eager to share what you've taught me so far, right? You know, I heard this, so anyway, acceptance is a big thing. I heard this at a meeting the other day, and they said, if you want to feel better, go to meetings. If you want to get better, work the steps. And if you want to be better, get a conscious contact and you have to have. Right? Isn't that true? I love that, right? I write some of this stuff down. Somebody said, for real, I have a notebook. Somebody, my accountant said, I don't think you're supposed to do that. I was like, what? Nobody can see me. I'm on Zoom. I mean, why wouldn't you be able to take notes anyway? But that's how interesting this meeting was. So, like, I was hearing some freaking profound stuff. I'm like, yeah, that shit down. Like, it was good. Somebody said he would ask his sponsees every day, what is my level of acceptance compared with my unmanageability, right? We were talking about that the other day. So, you know, how does it lay out? Like, am I more in the acceptance realm today, or am I all fucking unmanageable? Most of the time, if we're in the acceptance, we're manageable. It's easy. It's easy peasy. Lemon squeezy. Me, that's what it is. Like, if you accept some stuff or everything, how hard is it? Not hard. All I can do is change me. I can't change you. And if I accept you, I pretty much are going to love you. And if I accept that you came, I don't know where you guys came from, right? You know, some people have been through some treacherous childhoods. My childhood was cool. Right? I had five brothers and a sister, and I hung in the country, like climbing trees and dirt bikes and shit like that. You know, smoked a little weed.
Stuff like that.
We did that. That was cool. I had it good. My father worked his ass off. Nobody molested me. Nobody smacked me around. You know, shit like that. I mean, I don't know why I turned out so fucked up. You know, it's hard to figure because we came from decent place. I don't know, but I think I just started smoking weed. You know, one day I just didn't say, go, that's what happened. And even the dealer said, don't do it. This dude begged me. And I was like, I got money. Like, I thought you had to sell it to me because I had money. Like this is the law. You have to sell to me. And this is what he said to me. He said, look, if you do this, I'm going to become your star and your moon. And in a week, that motherfucker was my stars and my movie, right? He was my best friend. So anyway, that's where the shit came. I had a habit. I was in the grip. So, I said all that to say, there's nothing I'm more grateful for in my life than Narcotics Anonymous. I love this program. And I've been blessed with the best sponsorship family. It gives me, I'm not sure how I landed with these women, But it's like, I just always get chills. So I really love you guys, even though I know it sounds corny, like I don't know you, but I know you, because we all been to the same place. And if we work this thing, you know, like I do, you'll get all these gifts and be happy and free and peaceful. That's it.
Then our second speaker, Chris, is going to come up and share with us what at the end of the rooms.
Cover night, name Chris.
Truly, truly grateful to be here. And again, still had the willingness to participate in this thing called Recovery in Narcotics Anonymous. And I just want to thank Elaine, right, for sharing. That was like really organic. I don't know about anybody else, but that was like really real for me. You know, I could feel you pushing through on that, and thank you. I enjoyed that. You know, so. But I just want to take a minute to welcome anybody that's new to Narcotics Anonymous. If this is your first experience with trying to get clean and stay clean and recover from the disease of addiction, welcome to Narcotics Anonymous. You never, ever, 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 ever have to use drugs again. You know? And that was like, when I first came to NA, like I never believed, I'm going to talk a little bit about a couple different things, but I never believed that I would have the life that I have today. You know, I never believed that I'd be the person I am today. I would never have believed that I was going to become the man I am today. If you would have told me that I would be a husband, I would have never believed that either, you know. So I'm going to read something. I got to put my glasses on because I can't see shit because I'm old. So it's out of our basic text, and it's the topic. You know, I'm a literature guy about addicts, by addicts, for addicts. That's what it says in the beginning of our basic text. I don't know, you know, why we wouldn't read the literature. It's important. So we do recover chapter 8. It says, when at the end of the road, we find that we can no longer function as human beings, either with or without drugs. We all face the same dilemma. What is there left to do? There seems to be this alternative. Either go on the best we can to the bitter ends, jails, institutions, or death, or find a new way to live. In years gone by, very few addicts ever had this last choice. Thank God for our predecessors. Thank God for Jimmy Kay. Thank God for the perseverance. You know, thank God for the tenacity. Thank God for not giving up. Because where would we be? Those who are addicted today are more fortunate. For the first time in man's entire history, a simple way has been proving itself in the lives of many addicts. It is available to us all. This is a simple, spiritual, not religious program known as Narcotics Anonymous. You know, so everything I needed to know about how to stay clean and recover from the disease of addiction, I learned at my very first Narcotics Anonymous presentation. That was 1989. I was 19 years old in Leesburg State Prison, and thank God for H&I, hospitals and institutions came in, and I was 19, you know, I was there for a strong arm robbery, intent to commit bodily harm, and theft by unlawful taking, right? That sounds bad, right? But it was like $80 and two fingers of weed. But I told everybody it was $800 and 2 pounds of weed. That just sounded a lot better, you know? So H&I came in, and everything I needed to know was the 8 suggestions on the front of the meeting list back then. Now there's 9. So, but at the time, I was 19 years old, and our literature talks about the disease of addiction wasn't apparent to me at that time. I didn't believe that I was an addict. I didn't believe that. You couldn't tell me that. I was 19 years old in prison for a drug-related crime, and our literature talks about it. Some of us will spend the rest of our lives in prison for a drug-related crime. But I just couldn't see it, you know? And with my denial in hand, I left that institution and went on to go to so many more. But I say all that to say, if you're here and you're new, the simple suggestions on the front of the meeting list, you know, and you know, one of my most profound moments in Narcotics Anonymous for me, after, I'm not going to get into the whole drug-a-log or anything like that, I'm just going to tell you about the end, and then I got a couple other things I want to share with you guys about how my life is today and what it's been like through this journey in Narcotics Anonymous and being at the end of the road in some relationships in my life. So, let me see. I just want to touch on something else real quick, because I lost my train of thought there for a second. But maybe it'll come back to me. But anyway, so I went at the end of the road for this addict. I ended up going to a bunch of different institutions. The disease of addiction. I knew where I was, but I'll get back to it. It manifested itself in a variety of mental obsessive compulsive behaviors, and some that had nothing to do with drugs. You know, I was addicted to a lot of other things. When I was a kid, you know, my very first fantasy was, like pretending that I was someone else. You know, pretending that I could go live at somebody else's house, because my best friend, their house was a lot different than mine. And I'll tell you why, you know. So August 27th, 1979, and this is my story. It don't change. It is what it is. A lot of people in here in this room know my story, you know, but that day changed my life forever. I was 10 years old, and my mother said, "Don't you take your little brother down the lake." And she went inside, and I did. I took him to the lake. And he jumped in the lake, he fell in the lake and started to drown. So I went home and got my two brothers, and they came down the lake and they started to drown. And then some people in the neighborhood came out and they helped. And then, you know, my last memory of my mom, she ran past me and jumped in the lake, and she made the ultimate sacrifice, and I watched my mother drown, saving my little brother. And I drug that around with me through active addiction, and thought that when I found my first substance, that was what I had been waiting for all my life. That was going to cure my pain, you know. But that wasn't the truth, you know. I was really identifying with Elaine, and I too, at the end of my road, I lived my life in between. And I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but I'll explain it. When the last one's gone and before you get the next one, that time in between, when all you can think about is the harm you caused to get that last one, and then knowing that you're going to have to do the same thing to get the next one. So that time in between was like hell for me, you know? And having a little bit of information, you know? So, you know, a lot of kind of things have just, you know, really started to resonate with me when she was sharing, and when I was listening to the men's rap or the men's sponsorship thing. You know, I'm overwhelmed at some of the relationships in my life. You know, God's really eased a lot of pain in my heart. You know, but anyway, so I spent probably almost 17 years in active addiction, 15 years on paper, 22 arrests, you know, 3 felony convictions, over 7.5 years in the New Jersey prison system, all behind just one more, you know. And I truly believe that I was, for whatever reason, trying to just be at peace and be okay with and feel good about myself with what happened with my mom. And then, you know, no matter what I did, it never turned out right, you know. And I could never just not use, you know. And I was always switching a substance because this substance was a problem or those people were the problem. And I was never really getting, our literature really clearly talks about it. You know, we have two problems, a major problem and an ultimate problem. The major problem was my uncontrollable drug use, but the ultimate problem was me. You know, and until I was able to get there through some step process and sponsorship, I just don't know where I would be. You know, so, you know, I really believe that desperation is a gift. I truly believe that, you know, and that desire, you know, comes in fleeting moments. And when desperation and desire meet, willingness is born. And I don't know why, and I don't know how. And the second step talks about the desire to use will be lifted. And I don't know where it went. Only God knows. He ain't telling and I ain't asking. But for some reason, that's taken place in my life. Do not have a desire to use drugs. And I remember, I'm a creature of habit. I do things that work for me over and over and over. And I'm like an escape artist. And I have three brothers. I have two older brothers and a younger brother. And all my brothers, when I was growing up, my oldest brother went on to become a white hat chef. And my other brother went on to have a construction company and do very well. And my little brother, who was my hero for a long time, graduated from Fairleigh Dickinson with a 4.0 Dean's List. And, you know, there was a lot of turmoil as kids growing up, you know. My dad, after my mom died, my dad had remarried a woman that was supposed to love us and nurture us and help us grow into the men that my mother would have wanted us to be. And we became victims of child abuse. You know, I'm very familiar with that term today. I know what that looks like. And more importantly, I know what that feels like. You know, and I, when I say that, I don't mean like she was a bad parent. I mean that she abused us physically, emotionally, spiritually, mentally. And she would put locks on the food and one roll of toilet paper a month. You know, and like just crazy off the wall stuff. What I've come to realize after 20 years of recovery and some step work, you know, and come to the realization that she was making decisions based in the hell that she was living in, because my stepmother and my father were addicted to the drug alcohol. You know, so today I have a lot of understanding about that, but coming in here at that time, you know, when at the end of my road story was a very sad story. You know, my brothers had gone on to quote unquote be professional. At 31 years old, I had nothing. I was a three-time convicted felon. I had no driver's license. I had no formal education whatsoever. I never had a bank account. I never had a checkbook. I wrote checks. They weren't mine, but I wrote some checks. You know what I mean? You got to do what you got to do. But, you know, so I came in here a very broken adult male who had a lot of childhood trauma and all this stuff. And if that's not your story, if that didn't happen to you, that's okay, because this is my story and our literature defines it. You know, it's not what we used or how much we used, it's what happens to us when we do. It's how Chris M. responds to drugs in his body like nothing else, like no other. And maybe you don't respond that way. Maybe somebody else don't respond that way. But what happens to me is just emotionally staggering. I believed that the next one was going to take away what happened with my mom. I believed the next one was going to allow me to get revenge against my stepmom. I believed the next one was going to give me the courage to tell my dad how I felt about him. Right? You know, because he let this woman do these things to us. I struggled with that. You know, I came in here with a lot of stuff and struggled, you know. And I don't really have a lot of time, so I'll just tell you guys what happened, you know. So I was on the ass end of a 32-month prison bid. And I used every day that prison sentence, prescription medication that I didn't need. I'm a chameleon. So I would get in the prison system and I would ask somebody that was nodding or dipping what kind of medication they were on. And then I would say, what are your symptoms? I would ask them. And then I would go tell the psych exactly that kind of stuff and then get the same kind of medication. I would fall off the chair and flop around on the floor just to get some medication. You know, so they diagnosed me special needs. You know, they said I was ADD, ADHD, all that stuff. I got it written down. I mean, the doctors wrote that shit down. But I was just ADDICT. You know, I was just an addict trying to use. You know, so a miracle happened, and I need to tell you from 1989 until this time, I had been by the courts forced to go and get a paper signed, and thank God for the paper in my life throughout all those years of having to come to meetings for the little bit of time I was on the street and on parole and go and get this paper signed, because you guys poured into me some stuff that I wasn't willing to hear or wasn't ready to accept, but somehow it went inside and I was able to retain that knowledge and able to quote some of the literature, and had a head full of NA and a body full of dope, and I couldn't stay clean. And I've had no practical application of this new way to live that everybody talked about, you know. And I tell you, my biggest fear coming to Narcotics Anonymous was just being found out that I really wasn't who I portrayed to be on the streets and in prison. You know, I really wasn't a tough guy. You know, I had some friends and cousins that had reputations of being like, you know, street fighters and brawlers and all that. I mean, I had a couple knockouts. They weren't looking, but I still counted them. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? I'm the guy that's like, you know? You know. But I was not a tough guy, you know? And so fear of being found out was really like paralyzing for me, you know. So at the end of that bid, you know, some things in my spirit started moving, and it's amazing when I look back and see how God was moving all the pieces. And at the time, I had no belief in that, nor did I want to have any belief in that. And now when I look back in hindsight, it couldn't have been anything other than the God of my understanding, you know. And so 2-3 months before I'm ready to leave, the parole gave me a date. And I went to the psych and I said, you know what, doc, I feel a little better. I don't think I need this medication. Because I knew one thing about myself. If I would have left the prison system with that medication, I probably would have used it all. You know, and it would have been, I would have went on a tear, you know. So I had this, like a spark of a desire to try to do the right thing. So I left prison on a Wednesday clean. I was clean physically, you know. I had no, it's called institutional abstinence, all right? I had institutional abstinence. You know, I really didn't have any experience with any type of life-changing recovery. There was nothing that changed from here to here. And I went home on a Wednesday, and I went to work on a Thursday, and went back to my father's house. My father had gotten divorced from that woman, and she had later on passed after I was clean a couple of years. But my dad had did all my laundry again, you know, and I lived in my father's house all my active addiction. I never took the trash out. I never cut the grass. I never did the dishes. And I never gave him any money. And I demanded that he send me money when I went to prison. And I held my father hostage in his own home. And I used emotional blackmail to do it. You know, and it was a horrible way. And I'm able to make amends to my father today with all that. And hopefully I'll be able to get to that. So anyway, what ended up happening was that night, that Thursday, I went to work, and that night I got two and used. And I did something that I've never done before, and I've heard it before in our literature when we're using against our will. I hitchhiked from my town, Mays Landing, to Egg Harbor City. It's about 6 or 7 miles, maybe 8 miles, and I hitchhiked the whole way there, knowing that it was a bad idea, knowing that it wasn't going to be good. But something, the literature says we're dealing with a violent, destructive power. right? And I couldn't, I just couldn't not use. And I get there, I get to, and I waited till I got home. I used, and, you know, I've heard some things in the rooms, and our literature talks about a moment of clarity. We come face to face with our addiction, with the disease, and we can no longer rationalize or justify, you know, the most outrageous sort of nonsense and the mess we made of our lives. And I remember sitting in my bathroom in my little rancher in Harding Lakes, where I always came back to, and here I am again and again. I just did a third prison bid. I'm 31 years again. I look in the mirror and I'm like, who is this person? And I'm like, all right, God, I need some direction here, you know? And I, what do I do? And this might sound real crazy to some people or whatever, but the only thing in my head that I heard was, go back to jail. And I'm like, cool. It was the craziest thing. And what's even crazier is that the next, I stayed up all night, and that morning, 5:01, I took the bus to Atlantic City and went to parole. And I was a mess, and I walked in there, and I was crying, and the lady was sitting behind the glass, and, you know, I banged on the glass, and she was like, hello? And I was like, yeah, my name's so-and-so. And she's like, what are you doing here? Weren't you just here on Wednesday? And I'm like, yeah, but I used. And she was like, why? I was like, I don't fucking know. I wanted to reach right through the hole and poke her in the eye, you know? So I sit down, and there's this guy there on the, she said, have a seat. I sit down, and there's like three chairs, and there's a guy sitting next to me, and he's like, yo, you're going to jail. I was like, I know. That's why I'm here. I'm going to jail today. Today, you know? And I could tell you this without equivocation. I believed a lot through my active addiction that, like, what I was capable of and so on and so forth. But something had eluded me. I knew that if I went on another run, I didn't know what I would be capable of. I was capable of anything. And I didn't want to harm anybody. I didn't want to hurt anybody or myself, you know. And more importantly, I was spiritually bankrupt. So this lady comes out of the back, and she had her little gun and badge on, and she was like, come back here. So I go in the back, and I know the routine. I know what's happening, you know. I'm going to jail, you know what I mean? And I still had this stink on me from the prison system. I was still wearing state clothes. I had state boots on, you know. And I remember sitting in the little cubicle that she had, and she says to me, well, what happened? And I said, I used. And she was like, why? I was like, the fuck, nobody knows why here? You know? I need, and in my head, in that moment, I said, I need to go where people know why, and I knew right where I needed to go. You know? And I had no idea the journey that God was going to take me on. You know? But she went over, they took my urine, and there were a couple people over there, this guy and her, and they were kibitzing. So she comes back to me and she says, Mr. McCumber, she says, since you've been so honest, you think you could leave and come back on Wednesday with a clean urine? And everything in me was like, yeah, go! You know? But I said, no. She was like, she looked at me like I had 12 heads. I was like, you have no idea. You have no idea. So she, real quick, she put the handcuffs on me. And I went to jail that day, and I've been clean ever since. You know, that was May 5th of 2001, you know. And something happened. I went, and when we have an unconditional surrender, and you were talking about it, you know, that surrender, that with that surrender comes peace. And, like, with that peace comes acceptance. And, like, I had accepted exactly what was going to happen. And parole came to see me. They gave me an 18-month hit. And I was happy to get it. Because for some reason, something had happened in my spirit. Now, I didn't know that I was going to come up here and be standing here before you guys. I didn't know any of that. I didn't know that I was going to be a 12-step member, blah, blah, blah. I didn't know any of that. All I knew was that I wasn't going to go back out on the street. Because I was a low-bottom addict. I had to jump up to touch bottom. You know, there was no, at the end of my road, there was no pounds and bricks and ounces or bundles. It was $5. You know what I mean? It was like $5. And, like, if you were with me and we were sharing one, and you were slow, you might have got a water shot. Like there was, we weren't going to the club and getting our eagle on. Nobody was dropping it like it was hot. It was like $5. $5. You know? And parole gave me that hit. And then 2 weeks later, the CO banged on the bubble and he's like, McCumber, go down to visit hall. I said, I did that already. I'm going to prison. He said, go back down there. So I go down there, parole's there, and they said, you know, Mr. McCumber, we're going to take back that 18-month hit and we're going to give you a 90-day drug program. And do you want it? In Newark, New Jersey, on Doremus Avenue. So I did that in May of 2001. And I stayed there until a little after 9/11. And I watched the towers fall, incarcerated. And I had some time, a couple of months clean. You know, I hadn't really endeavored into the recovery process, but I was clean and I was willing. You know, and I was willing to do whatever came next. You know, and they said, don't go home. And I said, you know, I can identify today where I made the right decisions and where I didn't, you know. And when I started saying okay, instead of asking why, my life started getting real easy. They were like, Chris, you got to go over there. I was like, okay, you know. And it's the same thing in my active addiction, you know. When my cousin Richie was showing me how to cook Coke, he's like, this is what you got to do. 6 months later, I'm showing my brother, this is what you got to do. You know, and you know, just like the literature. If a crack pipe came with instructions, you'd be like this. Don't skip a step. You know what I mean? But we don't want to read the literature. So I go and I go to this recovery environment in Ocean City. And that's when life took off for me. And that's when I started to endeavor in the step process. And the first step, it talks about reservations. And I used to believe that a reservation was something that would happen to me where I would have to use to survive the hurt. And what I've come to understand for this addict, for Chris M., is a reservation is simply anything I'm not willing to do for my recovery. If it's suggested that I get a home group and I don't have one, it's a reservation. If it's suggested that I get a sponsor and I'm not utilizing that sponsor, it's a reservation. If it's suggested that I work 12 steps and I'm not, it's a reservation. So that hit me like a ton of bricks. So this time round, you know, I got a sponsor, a home group, and I'll never forget, you know, I went to Atlantic City, and I know God is pleased with his spirit, but Mubashir was there, and I had almost a year clean, and I had gotten a home group, and I left that facility, and I was living in this recovery environment, and I was shopping for a sponsor, because you don't know, I'm special. You gotta be the right guy for me, you know? My hair was really thinning back here, so I got a bright idea. Let me dye it blonde and cut it real short so I look like Eminem, because Slim Shady was like the thing back then, you know? And I wore this bandana that had a knot in the front, knot in the back. I didn't know if I was Tupac or Eminem, but I was coming. I was showing up, man. Identity crisis and all. And Moose said to me, hey, Christy, baby, did you get a sponsor yet? And I said, I'm waiting. He said, what are you waiting for? The literature says the sooner. The literature says don't wait. It says the sooner we face our problems. So he said, right in the literature, those who get the most out of this program are those to whom sponsorship is important. You know, and then 2 nights later, it was a third step meeting at Sherry's home group. This guy, Greg C., shared and changed the condition of my heart. And my life's never been the same. That night, I believed. After he shared about his mom and dad committing suicide and his dad overdosed, and he was there, and he was like wide open. And it's so ironic how I am. I'm like the guy that shoots the messenger before I have a chance to hear the message, because that's how self-centered I am. Because if you don't look like me, walk like me, talk like me, drink like me, drug like me, act like me, listen, I can't hear you. That's how closed off of an addict I was. But something happened. That meeting, that night, just split me wide open. The hair on my neck stood up, and I thought for 1 second, this guy can help me with my mom. I never thought that I would ever be able to be free from that, you know? And I asked him to sponsor me. He said it would be an honor and a privilege and all that. And then You know, these are some of the most profound things that have happened to me. You know, in the beginning of my recovery, he said, I said, okay, Greg, what do I got to do now? He said, you write, we go over it, you know. And I said, okay. He said, how well do you want to get, you know. And he said, I'll match your willingness, you know. So we went through the 12 steps and my life got good and, you know, it got, things were real and then it got real good and then it just got real. You know, and I had a life, and I was working in treatment, and I had a life, and I moved out of the house, and I got a driver's license, and I had a life, you know, and I had responsibilities, and I started a business with a bike, a bucket, and a tool belt, because I had 22 arrests and 3 felony convictions, and nobody was going to hire me. He said, what are you good at? So I'm good with my hands. He said, you might have to make a job. So I did that, and I walked on job sites with my friend, kid I sponsored, man I sponsored at the time. And a year later, I bought a van and had a helper. 2 years later, I had another van. 5 years later, I had a bunch of trucks and a bunch of guys. And all the while, I was working in treatment, and life was good. And I met this woman in recovery. And, you know, so that's my one at the end of the road story. But, you know, my recovery journey has continued. But I'm going to talk real quick about 2 things, and then I'm going to get out. So, you know, the 12 Steps of Narcotics Anonymous has transformed my life. I have a life in Narcotics Anonymous. You know, the 12 Step talks about we need to remain visible and available. You know, and the 11th Step talks about without this step, it's highly unlikely we'd be able to have a sufficient message to carry this message, of recovery. I truly believe that the 12 steps have transformed my life. I'm not the person I used to be. I don't believe what I used to believe. I came in here a guy that was like this whole prison mentality, this whole institutional living, snitches get stitches. Hey, do some shady shit around me today. I will call the cops on you in a minute. 911, he's wearing a red hat and blue sneakers. He's running down the road. Right? Because that didn't serve me then and it don't serve me now. You know? And so I'm going to talk about, you know, at the end of the road in certain relationships, because of the 12 steps, I've been able to show up, suit up and show up, and things have utterly transformed my life. I never was, my mom died, she left, abandonment stuff. My stepmom beat me, and that was horrible. The nuns, my stepmom signed a paper that said the nuns at the school could discipline us, right? So then this is what discipline was for the nuns at my school. You get in line with other boys and you pull your pants down, right? And then they spank you with your everything out, genitals and everything. That was discipline, right? So women in my life, I remember telling Greg, my first sponsor, I got women issues, Greg. I got women issues, right? I could catch, but I couldn't keep. I couldn't hold. I wasn't spiritually equipped to hold. All I saw you was for my immediate wants, needs, and desires, and that was it. After that, you got to go, because I'm scared now. I'm afraid now, because you're going to eventually leave, or you're going to hurt me somehow. So I said, Greg, I got women issues. He said, no, Chris, we got to do more step work. You got Chris issues. Not women issues. You got Chris issues. You know, and God did something amazing in my life. He put this woman in my life. And I lived, at the time, it was, I'll go back a little, I lived in this recovery environment, and this woman lived next door. And she just got custody of her little girl. And she was like loud and brash. And I'm like, oh my God, this bitch is crazy. And then she would come to me, but she lived right next to it. And I was like going to meet. I made a meeting every day for 6 years, right? And I would, and all of a sudden, one day turned into one, we would go to the meeting. Next day, we're going to another meeting. In 3 days, we're going to another meeting. And she had a sponsor. Her name was Christine. And she was doing her thing, and I was doing my thing. And I truly believe that at some point in time, my thought process was like, man, I could marry her. You know? At one time, I was like, man, this could be like, I could get like a wife out of this, you know? I mean, like, I don't know about you guys, but the broker you are, the more I want to fix it, you know? And I know at some point in time she kind of felt that way. But God had other plans, right? So her sponsor was giving her direction. My sponsor was giving me direction. And the end result was like, we developed this platonic relationship that was based on friendship and not sex. Not what you can get, what I can get, you know? And everybody in the area thought we were like dating, you know? And it didn't happen like that. you know. And we developed a friendship, and I learned how to have a woman as a friend without expecting anything in return sexually. That was very different for me. And had I known what I would have thought then, I didn't know that that relationship was preparing me for the relationship with my wife today. I didn't know that, you know. But at the end of her road, she picked up and used. But at the end of her road, she was also sick. She came here with something else that she couldn't get well from, and medically. And I walked with her through that and helped raise her daughter through that. You know, and her daughter Kayla is still alive and doing well, but, you know, and her name was Carrie Ann, and I love her, and I love her, and she was so special, you know, but she just didn't, you know, whatever reason. And but at the end of her road, I was visible and available and able to show up, and because it didn't look like how I thought it should look, I didn't leave, and because in spite of how it made me feel. You know, and then my wife was like, you know, at the time, she was my girlfriend, and, you know, she understood the situation, and she was like, well, let's encourage her. And then we got to a place where it was like, you know, let's just keep walking her through this, you know. And she passed, you know. And I had another a friend of mine, Joe M., who, next door to that recovery house, his wife lived, and his wife's Debbie, and she came over to me one day and said, my ex-husband Joey is coming home from prison, and you know, he's going to need to go to meetings, and blah blah blah. And one thing led to another, and we went to some meetings, and you know, I started taking him to, we go to meetings, and he jumped in with 2 feet and 10 toes, and I sponsored Joey for about 5 years, and we went through the step process, and you know, at some point in time, we both ended up on the same step together. But we had this journey together in Narcotics Anonymous, and we went everywhere together, and they called him Joey Numbers. He had like 5 black books with all phone numbers in it, and he was like everywhere, you know, all over in the name of Narcotics Anonymous, and he was a soldier for Narcotics Anonymous, and he believed in what we do here, you know. And then one day he stopped coming to meetings. You know, and I was still in contact with him. You know, and I'm talking to him, and I'm, you know, I don't know what's going on, and he's telling me he's sick. You know, he said he was sick, you know, and he said he couldn't come to meetings no more. So I called Dutch, and I said, Dutch, what's going on? Why would somebody with this much passion for Narcotics Anonymous just stop coming? He said, Chris, he either used or he did something he's ashamed of and can't come and talk about it. And that was it, you know. And but that's not even what happened with him. Ain't the issue. The issue is that he used, and then I stayed in touch with him throughout his whole active addiction, you know. And he would call me, and I knew he was telling me stories about the phone got turned off and he needed money, and I knew it. And I would give him the money anyway, and I would pick him up, and I would bring him clean socks, and I would bring him clean clothes, and I knew exactly where he was going, exactly what he was doing. And you know why I did it? Because I'm a fucking fan of the underdog. Because that's me. And I prayed that God would touch his spirit one more time. And I took him to treatment. And he left AMA, and he was gone for like 3 or 4 months, and then his wife called me, and his wife was a sweetheart, and his daughter was this big when I met him, and now she's a beautiful young lady, he's got 2 babies, and we talked to his wife, and me and my wife, and we're still in contact with her, and she called me, and she said he's in the hospital, you know, and he had OD'd in Atlantic City, and was 102 out. And people walked over him for 4 hours, and his brain fried like an egg. So I went to the hospital and showed up at the end of his road, because that's what Narcotics Anonymous told me to do. And I went to the hospital, and he had married his wife and divorced his wife and then married his wife again and then divorced his wife again, right? So that left his son Joey, who I met when he was 4, is now 21, the one to make the decision to pull the plug or not. But prior to that, they moved him to a nursing home. And I went to the nursing home. And I was like, man, this guy. So I go to the nursing home. It's so ironic. And I thought that he was going to, like, be aware, you know. And he was in the bed. And he couldn't talk. But his eyes, like, I was talking to him, and he was, like, motioning to me, and then he started writing stuff down. He couldn't talk, but he could write. And he said, did you talk to my son? And I talked. And he was in there, and I could see that he was in there at the end of his book. And I couldn't do anything. So I fed him applesauce. This is a man I sponsored and loved and cared about, you know, and I just left that nursing home that day wondering what happened. What happened? You know, and our literature talks about it, you know, it says if we're not honest, we're used again, you know, and he died. His little son had to pull the plug, and they didn't have any money. So I did some things and asked some people, and I knew some people in the town I grew up in. Privileged to be able to, you know, Narcotics Anonymous says people outside of NA will seek our counsel. So I have some relationships outside of NA. The same judge that sent me to prison twice I end up working with. The detective that cased me up and testified against me and sent me to prison is one of my best friends today. And my life is totally different, but I was able to have a memorial service for him and raise some money and give it to his kids and show up at the end of his road and be somebody in his life, even though his life was gone. Narcotics Anonymous has given me that. I'm able to show up in my life for my wife. My wife's mother, my mother-in-law, Louise, was the dear, sweet, everybody says, oh, wait till you get married, it's going to change, and now it's going to turn into a monster law, you know? And that's a lie. That's a lie. What we do here changes people's perception of who we are. My mother-in-law loved me. I would go see her at lunchtime, and I wouldn't even tell my wife, and she would make me sandwiches, and I would eat with her, and we would tell little stories back and forth, and I was always making her laugh, and she adored me. And she knew that I was going to make sure that her daughter was safe because of Narcotics Anonymous and how you guys taught me how to show up. I was able to make my mother-in-law feel comfortable with leaving and knowing that I was going to take care of my wife. You know, Narcotics Anonymous allowed me to be in the forefront and take a front row in some people's lives. You know, and thank God, my first sponsor, Greg, made some other moves, and about 11 years ago, I asked Barry to sponsor me, and I've been with Barry, and we've been walking through the 12 steps, and on his journey, and showing up in his life, you know, and having a front row seat in his life, and the men that he sponsors, my sponsee brothers, you know. You know, I don't know where, listen, at the end of my road, I hope you guys are here, you know, I hope you guys are here. One last thing, what I do today, I used to have a big business, and I didn't know what I was going to do with my life, but I'm a community person, I'm a community advocate, I'm an entrepreneur, I've gone from DOC to CEO, I have a nonprofit in the neighborhood I grew up in, and people thought I was crazy, but I said, we're going to do this, and we did it. And we opened up a 6,000 square foot, 10,000 the first time, and now we opened up a 6,000 square foot facility. So, you know, God had a plan for me that I didn't have for myself. I sold my construction business 3 years ago, and I was doing a job, and the guy that I was doing the job for was a social worker at Trenton Supermatch Prison. And I had confided in him a little just self-disclosure of who I was and where I came from. And he said, Chris, you'd be perfect for this job. And he put my name in the hat, so to speak, and they sent me an email to fill out the resume. I filled out the resume. I went on the job thing. I got the job. And it's with Rutgers University. And I'm a guy that has no high school education. I don't have no letters after my name. I have education. I have passion. That's what I have. I have passion and purpose. And then you guys gave that to me. You know? And today I work in the New Jersey State Prison System, and I go into every state prison that I was ever an inmate at. I'm in every prison. And you know where I'm at? I'm at the end of their road, waiting for them at the end of their road. So when at the end of your road, and while you're incarcerated, if you ever end up there, drop a slip and I'll come see you. My name's Chris. Thanks.